Let's get into the Word. We're in 2 Kings. 2 Kings chapter 5 is one of the truly cool accounts in the Old Testament, one of the really great stories that so many people know, and one of the famous ones, really, in a lot of ways. It's the story of the conversion of a Syrian field marshal, a commander whose main job was to kill Israelites. And he gets converted, and it is an amazing thing. What's amazing about it is it's so surprising to find out that God would work in the life and the soul of a person that we hate. Isn't that amazing? That God would not hate the same people we hate? We kind of always assumed he would, don't you? And yet he decides to work in the life of a man named Naaman. His name is probably Naaman, but we're going to call him Naaman because that's what everybody calls him in English. And he was a Syrian field marshal. He worked for Ben-Hadad, who was king of Syria in Damascus. They were sort of the arch enemies of Israel at the time, and this took place sometime between 851 and 841, about a 10-year period. We're not exactly sure, and when we get into these stories in 2 Kings, beginning here in chapter 5, there's some chronology situations. They weren't arranged chronologically always, but it's during that period, and there was a Cold War going on between Damascus and Syria and Israel, capital Samaria. The king in Samaria was Jehoram. I don't know if you remember him from the last time a few weeks ago when we talked about him. It was over 4 weeks ago now, I guess, so I'll remind you. He was the king in Israel, northern Israel. Jehoram was the king, was the son of Ahab and Jezebel, so he did not have a godly heritage, and he was not a godly man, really. He was superstitious. He was rather pagan in his heart, and yet when he got into trouble, he would want God, the real God of Israel, to help him. And he really represents a type of person that there is in the world who knows who God really is but prefers to worship around. But when they really get in trouble, they call on the real God. Well, that's the way Jehoram was, and he kind of plays into the account as well. Now, the main prophet on the scene is a man by the name of Elisha, who had been the servant of Elijah. Elisha, as a prophet in Israel, is a man who represents the voice of God to the kings. Now, always remember, during this period in Jewish history, it's called the divided monarchy, from the death of Solomon until the Assyrian captivity of northern Israel and then the Babylonian captivity in southern Israel, or in Judah. This period of the divided monarchy, always remember this, the voice of the prophets was the voice of God. The voice of the kings was the voice of civil government of Israel. And they didn't always agree. And in the north, they almost never agreed. See, the kings always thought they ought to be running everything. And God always thought he ought to be. And so, ideally, the prophets and the kings were supposed to work together, but in reality, they didn't. And so, in this situation, what we have is Elisha, the voice of the Lord, and Jehoram, who thinks he ought to be running the kingdom, and something that God does in the life of a complete rank pagan who was not godly, didn't even want to be godly until this happened. Fascinating, fascinating account. But before I move on, let me remind all of us that you can think in terms of this period of history and this part of the Word of God. I want you to think of it this way. What I just said about the prophets and the kings, I want you to think in terms of the heart of a believer and the mind. The heart and the mind are supposed to go together, and they're both supposed to belong to God. But very often, there's something about our old minds that says, I ought to be running my life. Huh? And then the voice of God comes into the heart of a believer and says, no, I'm supposed to be telling you how to think. When you think of Israel during this period and when you see the conflicts between the real prophets and these kings, I want you to remember the difference between having the Lord just in your heart emotionally and having him in your heart and your mind, in the administrative center where you think like a genuine believer, as well as in the emotive center where you want to say, I belong to God. It's It all belongs to him, see. And it was this conflict that was sort of crazy-making, and it is a crazy-making conflict when you know you ought to do what God wants, but your head doesn't want to, so to speak. You know, your administrative center says, well, I'm going to run my life kind of like the world, but your heart says, yeah, but you belong to God. That's a crazy-making environment. That's the way it was in Israel. That's the way it was in Israel. Jehoram sort of represents the head, but the heart, the voice of God, is represented by the prophets, and in this case, Elisha, very, very famous prophet. Let's begin in 2 Kings chapter 5. It starts with an introduction to Naaman, the captain, or the field marshal of Syria. Now, Naaman, captain of the army of the king of Syria, was a great man with his master and highly respected. Because of him, the Lord had given victory to Syria. The man was also a valiant warrior, but he was a leper. And the word, the Hebrew word for leper, doesn't necessarily mean what we call Hansen's disease or true leprosy, but it is any incurable skin disease and a very, very difficult situation. He desperately wanted to be healed of this. Is anybody amazed by there in verse 1 where it talks about the Lord giving victory to Syria? Does that bother anybody? Does that, you ever wonder why the Lord might give victory to a nation other than Israel in the Old Testament? I wonder about it, and I think the Israelis wondered about it. But Israel wasn't walking with God, and one thing's for sure in this whole process, God is sovereign, even over the Gentile nations. When the victory happens, he's the one who gives it. Fascinating. Verse 2. Now the Syrians had gone out in bands and had taken captive a little girl from the land of Israel, and she had waited on Naaman's wife. They had been doing this Cold War thing, and they had been fighting around the edges of Israel for some time. And they had taken a young lady captive, and she became a servant to Naaman's wife. Now they had gone out in bands, verse 2, and had taken captive a little girl, and she gets used by the Lord. Watch how the Lord uses this little girl whose story we would consider a tragedy. Stolen from her home, taken to be a servant in the home of a Syrian field marshal. And that would be like being a Jewish child being taken and forced to be a servant in the home of a Nazi field marshal. We would think, this is terrible. Nothing good can come out of this. This is something wrong. But you know what's amazing is this little girl knows something that the Syrian general doesn't know, and she's willing to talk about it. She has no power. She has no authority. She has nothing she can offer except a piece of information. Is that really worth something? Well, Naaman is about to find out what that's worth. She said to her mistress, I wish that my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria. Then he would cure him of his leprosy. What a sweet thing for this girl to say. And yet, you know, she might hate Naaman. Apparently he wasn't a particularly hateful guy, or she would have hated him. But here you've got this sweet girl who's there. How long she's been there, we don't know, but she's sort of become attached to Naaman. She doesn't hope that his leprosy kills him. She hopes he gets healed, and she says, you know, if he could just talk to the prophet that's down in Israel, he could be healed. You know, I'm amazed at the simplicity that young people can have in the expression of their faith, that when an older person hears it, it's just unvarnished, it's just simple, it's just from the heart. It's like, well, if you knew God, such and so would happen. People underestimate the power of a young person who might not have all of the sophistication, might not have all of the polish, might not have all of the theological stuff, might not want to argue or even be able to. But a simple statement, well, you know, I know where the truth can be found. It's quite simple. It's down there. It's in Israel. And that's all she says. Verse 4, Naaman went in and told his master, so the word got to Naaman, And he went in and told Ben-Hadad. Doesn't call him that, but it was Ben-Hadad. And he says, thus and thus spoke the girl who's from the land of Israel. The king of Syria said, well, okay, go, get healed. And he sent a letter with him to the king of Israel. And he departed and took with him 10 talents of silver, that's a lot of money, and 6,000 shekels of gold and 10 changes of clothing. And he brought the letter to the king of Israel, and he said, now as this letter comes to you, behold, this is how the letter reads. As this letter comes to you, behold, I have sent Naaman, my servant, to you that you may cure him of his leprosy. Now the Syrians were very dangerous people. They had a big army. And they had fought Israel before. It'd been a tough time. They were in a sort of an uneasy peace at this time. And they were always looking for a little bit of an advantage. Jehoram, not a godly man, here's this letter. And look in verse 6. Notice it says, you. Jehoram is not thinking, maybe God will do this. Jehoram reads this completely from a worldly perspective. And he says, me? What do you mean? Me. And here's Field Marshal Rommel standing there with his tanks saying, you're going to do this for me. And he brought this big gift, and he's got this official letter from Ben-Hadad up in, you know, Damascus. And verse 7, it came about when the king of Israel read the letter that he tore his clothes. Probably not the response that they were hoping for. Because what it means is that the king has no idea how it is that he's supposed to do this, or how it is that was ever thought that he could, or that any such thing could possibly happen. The interesting thing, because he's the king of Israel, the God of the universe, who's made a covenant with Israel, has said over and over again, I will take care of you. And yet Jehoram doesn't think that way. He just doesn't think in spiritual categories at all. Remember, he's all right here in the head. It's about him. It's about what he does. It's not about what God does. It's not about whether God could do anything. Jehoram doesn't even think about whether or not he ought to ask God about it. He just tears his clothes and says, oh my goodness, look it. Am I God to kill and to make alive that this man is sending word to me to cure a man of leprosy? You've got to be kidding. Now look, he says, he's trying to seek a quarrel with me. He's looking to start a war. It happened when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, that he sent word to the king. How did Elisha hear that the king had torn his clothes? Well, word gets out when the king tears his clothes. But more than that, everybody would have heard, you know, the king tore his clothes. That was bad news. But more than that, Elisha actually had connections with the court. And we're going to see this later in the stories of Elisha. He's different than Elijah this way. His mentor was a man who lived pretty much in the desert, and when he came to town, they figured bad things were going to happen. Elisha, on the other hand, had a different kind of ministry. He actually had contact with the court regularly, he and his servants, specifically Gehazi, who we're going to meet tonight, had contact. So he probably heard about it right away. The word got to Elisha that something terrible had happened, and Jehoram was very worried. And Elisha views this thing from a completely different perspective. It's interesting how people who are walking with God can view the exact same environment, same exact circumstance, from a completely different perspective than a person who's not thinking like the Lord. And often the difference is between panic and a sense of opportunity. Often a person who's not thinking like the Lord might look at a situation and say, the sky is falling, this is terrible, this is the worst. Whereas a person who's walking with the Lord might say something like, you know, I think the Lord might have an opportunity to do something here. Perhaps there's something I can do to represent the Lord in it. Big difference in the way you view life. You see, on one hand, people view life as if they're in charge of it and God's watching. On the other hand, people can view life as if God's in charge of it and he brings things into our lives for the purpose of helping us and challenging us and teaching us. And see, Elisha views it differently. He heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, and he sent word to the king, verse 8, why have you torn your clothes? Now let him come to me, and he shall know that there really is a prophet in Israel. I heard that he's looking for a prophet. Have him come to me. Because he knows, of course, Elisha does, that there is only one God, which means The only real prophets, the only ones you can really turn to, are the ones that listen to that God. And he says, well, have them come to me. Not afraid to take the responsibility. Verse 9. So Naaman came with his horses and his chariots, like Rommel and his tanks, and stood at the doorway of the house of Elisha. Now, Naaman is a very important man. But notice how Elisha deals with him. And note carefully, because it offends Naaman terribly. Now, you would think that you would not want to offend a guy like this. But Elisha really doesn't care, and he does not want to give the impression to Naaman that he's going to bow down to Naaman or to Naaman's God, whose name was Rimmon. He's not even, I don't know how much Elisha knew of what was going on. He might have known more than we can see here. But whatever the case, he's not going to bow down, and he's not going to cater necessarily. He will help this man. He will serve this man. He will do what God told him to. But he's not going to, you know, make like Naaman is a real big gun with him. Verse 10, Elisha sent a messenger to him, probably Gehazi. So Naaman comes and he doesn't even get to talk to Elisha. Instead, he talks to Elisha's servant. And Naaman is not a man who's used to talking to other people's servants. He's a man who's used to when he knocks on the door, or when his servant knocks on the door, the head of the house comes and says, oh, Naaman, what can I do for you? Instead, the servant comes and rather unceremoniously gives Naaman some instructions. He just says, straight, go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored to you, and you shall be clean. Meaning, they called it cleansing when leprosy went away. You'll be clean of the leprosy. You'll be healed. Wash in the Jordan. Go dip yourself in the Jordan River 7 times. So here's Naaman, he's standing there, he's all ready for some big dramatic thing, as we're going to see in a minute. That's what he says he's ready for. And Gehazi, probably, comes to the door and says, you're supposed to go and dip yourself in the Jordan 7 times, and you'll be clean. Goodbye. I mean, he traveled a long way, he's got a whole parade with him, he's got a lot of money, they don't even want his money. Well, one of them does, but... It's very unceremonious. It's rather an insulting thing to a very important man. And he says so. He's furious, verse 11. Naaman was furious. He went away and he said, behold, I thought he would surely come out to me. He, meaning Elisha, he would come out to me and stand and call on the name of Yahweh, his God. It's interesting because he uses God's real name there, the word Lord there, Yahweh. He uses his real name. He would call on the name of Yahweh, his God. Naaman knows it's not his own God, but he thought, well, this guy, I thought he'd come out, call on the name of his God, and wave his hand over the place, and cure the leper. I thought this was going to be some big thing. Verse 12. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Your cheesy, little, muddy, stinky river in Israel. We've got better rivers that are attached to our rivers in Syria. I'm not going to go dip myself in this little mud hole just because you hokey mountain people up here think I ought to do it. And you didn't have the respect for my position to come out here and pay me some personal attention. He was just really ticked off. And he goes away in a rage. Couldn't I wash in those rivers and be clean? He turned and went away in a rage. But one of his servants came near and spoke to him. Interesting thing how sometimes people who are not in the spotlight have a kind of a clearer view than the people who are in the spotlight. And sometimes they just see it in the can step up, you know, and this guy does. He steps up and he says, my father, calls him his father, apparently Naaman wasn't a terrible person. This little girl liked him enough that to hope that he'd be healed. And this guy calls him his father, which is a term of endearment. And it indicates that perhaps Naaman was not a horrible man. My father, had the prophet told you to do something great, some big, great thing, you know, climb a mountain and slaughter 1,000 animals and yada yada, you'd have done that. Wouldn't you have done it? How much more then when he says to you, wash and be clean? well, that's logical. And so Naaman thinks that through, and he says, okay, verse 14. Naaman must not be too bad of a guy, and I'll tell you why. First of all, he will let this person who works under him actually talk to him and even correct him. So he must not be too bad of a person. And secondly, he will admit when the other person's point is good, no matter who the other person is. If the other person makes a good point, he's willing to say, well, you know what? That's a good point. And I'll tell you something. He wouldn't have become a good general had he not had the ability to see through some things and take advice when it came. You can't be a good leader if you're not able to listen to what somebody says and see the logic of it, if it's truly logical. One of the gifts of leadership is the ability to say, you know what, I don't care who thought of that, that's a good idea. That actually meets the need of the moment. And it might not have been my idea, it might have been somebody else's, and it might even have been somebody's idea that doesn't have a lot of clout, but it's a great idea. And a good leader is able to do that. For the fact that Naaman was a pagan, that he was an enemy of Israel, that he really wasn't seeking God, all he wanted to be was healed of his leprosy. He didn't want to actually be converted to Yahweh, which is what ends up happening to him. We know all that about him, and yet there must have been some character in this man. And you can see it as he interacts. So anyway, so the servant says, look, give it a try. And so he does. He goes down and he dipped himself 7 times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God. And his flesh was restored like the flesh of a child. And it was clean. Kid's skin. You know, the older you get, the more you look at kid's skin and say, that's really marvelous. You know, when you're young, you don't think about it. But the older you get, you look at skin. And he comes up like smooth and shiny, like kid's skin. And can you imagine this guy? He takes off his armor, you know, and he's an important guy. He takes off his armor, he goes down there, wades into the Jordan River, and I don't know what time of year it was, but if it was not the height of the season, the Jordan River is really not impressive. It's not that big. He might have had to get down a couple times to get all wet on the edge of it. And he does it once, pops up. All of his servants and all of his people are looking at him, you know. It's humiliating. And so he does it again, and 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 he does it again. 7 times. And I imagine each time he comes up and looks at his skin, looks up at his guys, and they're going, all right. They're all counting for him, you know. And he goes down again. He finally comes up, and he looks, and he goes, oh. And yeah! I mean, he just totally changes at this moment. His whole life changes. He is amazed that doing this hokey thing in this dinky little river should do this, should so change him. He almost can't believe it. I'll bet he couldn't believe it. I mean, it was a last-ditch effort to go to his enemies and ask their God for a favor. He probably thought, everything's against me to do this. And then it's infuriating and humiliating to do it. Anyway, that's an amazing scene. It's an interesting thing. How many people put off getting baptized? And you only have to get dunked once. Just a thought. I mean, you know, if you haven't been baptized, you might want to consider this. What was the matter with Naaman? Well, there were some character things about him that I think were good, and I mentioned those. But also, he had a couple of problems that almost stopped him from getting healed. If it hadn't have been for his servant who came and said these things to him, let me mention just two. First, of course, his personal pride got in the way of his walk with God. And that is what happens so often among us. People are just plain proud. And the older they get and the more important they are and the more stuff they have in the world, the harder it is to just come and say, I am like everybody else. And you know, it's interesting because God did not make it easy for him. Elisha did not talk to him. I mean, from the moment Naaman got there, it was made very clear he was no better than any dirty old Israeli person who needed the grace of God. And the pride got in his way. Had it not been for some wisdom on his part to listen to somebody who poked him in the pride and popped it a bit, and then he said, you know, you're right, I ought to give this a try. And the horrible nature of the illness that he had, that it was worth whatever humiliation this might be to give it a try. Whatever the case, it finally got rid of his pride. It's tough when the Lord does a pridectomy. It's one of the most painful surgeries, and he doesn't even use anesthetic when he does it, usually. It just hurts like crazy. But afterwards, there's this great relief. Because a really big ego is a very, very heavy weight to bear. And it gets in the way between people and God all the time. But Naaman somehow got through it. But his pride had been in the way. And there's another thing that got in the way that almost stopped him. And it was his view of the miracle. He thought it was about this muddy little river. That's why he was so mad. This stinky little river, I don't have to go dunk myself 7 times in your stinky little river. I've got better rivers at home. But it wasn't ever about the river. See, he misunderstood what was really going on. It was never about the river, the Jordan River. It was about God, whose people Israel were. It was about God. It was about Yahweh. It was never about the mighty little river. It was always about the Lord. And one of the things that keeps people, and I know from personal experience, this is my story, one of the things that keeps people from coming to the Lord is that they've got their mind on the hokiness of the church instead of on the glory of God. And the church, my friends, makes a lot of mistakes. If you've been around for a while, if you've been involved in ministry, you know how many mistakes are made. How hokey church can be. How downright mistaken it is sometimes, because humans are humans. But it's never really been about how impressive the Jordan River was. It's always been about who God is and the fact that that water belongs to Him. The Jordan River comes out of the Galilee. It comes from the Sea of Galilee, which is, in those days, was the only freshwater source and the main freshwater source for Israel. To this very day, people are just unwilling to see the fact that there's more to God's water than H2O. And that, yeah, you can generate some of your own spiritual stuff, but if it doesn't come from God, if it doesn't come straight from Him, through Jesus Christ, the Galilean, it's useless. It's completely useless. You live in a world right now that wants your attention spiritually. Just remember, Syria had lots of rivers. And there are a lot of spiritual sources out there that will say to you, look, our rivers are clear and cool, and I tell you, they're impressive. Come out and try our spirituality. Try this on. And the church, the body of Christ, for all of its history and all of its ups and downs and all the hokiness of it at times, this isn't all that impressive. It's not that impressive. But make no mistake about it. The real nourishment, the water Jesus talked about to the woman at the well in Samaria, the water that when you drink it, you never thirst again, it comes from God. And as simple as that sounds, it is the truth. Always has been. Always will be. So Naaman needed to get past his pride, and he needed to understand that the nature of the miracle had nothing to do with the river itself. It had to do with God Himself. Now, he does get past that. And what happens is, he actually becomes converted. He's an amazing person because of who he is. He comes to the Lord, but does not become Jewish. He's a little bit like the Ninevites, who under Jonah's ministry repented and believed in Yahweh. And it leaves a big question mark, frankly, in our minds, because this guy goes back to Syria. He's a field marshal. He doesn't quit his job. He goes back to Syria. How did God do that? What did God do with this man after he converts? Because he does. How do we answer that on our theology exam? What are we going to say? Did God really love that guy? Did God really save that guy? Is that guy really converted just because he repented and gave his life to Yahweh? But he didn't act like, he didn't come and become Jewish. Actually, probably wouldn't have done him any good if he'd have come down to Israel and tried to be godly. He's probably better off up there all by himself than down with Jehoram and his crowd anyway. But you know, it is a question mark. And there are several like these in the Old Testament. Question marks. What is God going to do with that person? What did God do with the Ethiopian eunuch who got saved with Philip and then went back to Ethiopia? Well, you know what? We don't know. What a bummer. How dare the Lord work in people's lives without explaining this to us and telling us. We don't know. I don't know. I don't know what he did with Naaman after this. But it could very well be that when we get to heaven, Naaman will be there. Isn't that amazing? I mean, that's just amazing. It's just phenomenal that God actually likes Gentiles. It's an interesting thing, too, that Jesus uses this in Luke chapter 4 when he preaches the gospel. And he said there were a lot of lepers. He uses this very story. He said there were a lot of lepers in Israel. And God healed Naaman, a Gentile. And when he said that, of course, everybody in the synagogue was really mad at him. But the Lord is working among people that are not like us. And he loves people outside of our cultural background and outside of our traditions. He loves them through his covenant. Now, this man does come to Yahweh. God never says, well, I will accept your worship of Rimmon as if it were worship of Yahweh. He doesn't say that. In fact, Naaman knows better than to even ask, and you'll see how strong Naaman is about it. He knows he's got to worship Yahweh, and he's going to worship Yahweh. But just remember, God did this work sovereignly in this man's life, out of the blue. That's just an amazing thing. Verse 15, see how this works out. He returned to the man of God. He got healed. He's all pink and fresh, and he goes back to talk to Elisha. Now, this time, apparently, Elisha did talk with him. He goes back there with his whole company, and he came, and he stood before him, and he said, behold now, I know that there's no God in the earth but in Israel. So please, take a present from your servant. Now he's really from a full heart, wants to give all his money that he brought, and Elisha won't take it. As the Lord lives, before whom I stand, I am going to take nothing. And he urged him to take it, and he refused. There's a time in the Bible, it actually does explain how people who serve the Lord often take their living from the gospel. I mean, it says it in the New and the Old Testament, that the Lord arranges from among his people to support the people who do ministry full time. Nothing wrong with that. But there's a time when a person has to say, this is not about the money, and I'm dealing with a person who's not really a member of my group, and I don't want to give them the wrong impression, and so no money, I'm not taking anything. And this is one of those times. And Paul did the same thing when he preached at Corinth. And we're in 1 Corinthians now on Sundays, and we're going to talk about that a little. But this is one of those moments, and it's really very strong of Elisha, and he's not even tempted by this. He says, no, I don't want your money. Forget it. Take it. It's okay. I don't want it. Verse 17, Naaman said, well, if not, then please let your servant at least be given 2 mules load of earth. They would have the sacks on the mules, and he wanted to fill these sacks with dirt from Israel. It's interesting. For your servant will no more offer burnt offerings, nor will he sacrifice to other gods, only to Yahweh. Now, see, this is a sign of conversion. He's going to worship Yahweh, even though he's got to go back. He says, give me some dirt from Israel, and I will pour the dirt out in the place where I worship so that I can kneel on ground from Israel. Isn't that interesting? It was his way, and Elisha lets him do this. It was the only way he could do it. He wasn't going to defect to Israel. He had to go back. And interestingly, God says, apparently, that's okay. Go ahead and do it. Don't ask me. I don't know how that works. But we've been to Israel a few times, and every time we go, people bring little stuff back. Rocks, little bits of dirt, little bits of sand, little bits of water from the Jordan River, little vials of water from the Jordan River. People bring them back. Little mementos of the trip, you know. This is more than a memento for this guy. He really only wanted to worship on land that belonged to Yahweh. And in those days, they believed that gods owned land. And he wanted some of the land that God owned. Give me a bit of dirt that God owns, and I'll bring it home and I'll kneel on it. That was the idea. That's an interesting way to do it. verse 18. In this matter, may the Lord pardon your servant, he says to Elisha. Now he says, now listen, I've got this special thing I've got to do. When my master, Ben-Hadad, goes into the house of Rimmon to worship there, he's pagan, and he leans on my hand, I have to take him in there and help him bow down. And I bow down myself in the house of Rimmon. He says, I have to do this. When I bow down myself in the house of Rimmon, the Lord pardon your servant in this matter. Isn't that interesting? I have to go back. I have this job to do. I got to help my master. I got to tell him. I got to help him worship his God. But I want you to know something, Elisha. From now on, I'm taking this dirt. I'm going to kneel on this dirt. I'm only going to worship Yahweh. I wonder how many people here would say, you know what? You need to stay here and learn a few more rules before you go back. You can't go back there and do that. I'm not going to get too deep into that, but I think sometimes we are very, very strict about some things in some circumstances where the Lord is a bit more interested in what's going on in a person's heart. And we need to let the Lord be the Lord about that. Elisha knew full well that he wasn't going to ask this guy to defect, and he knew full well that this was an odd, bizarre situation, and he had no control over what Naaman was ever going to do again. And so he basically does the right thing. He says, well, okay, I understand. God understands. And you can imagine Elisha going back in the house after talking to this guy and thinking, wow, Lord, what are you doing? And he didn't tell him either, which is kind of a good thing for us. Verse 19, he says to him, just go in peace. And he departed from him some distance. So he heads on out. Well, Gehazi, he heard about the money. And he thought, oh man, we can't let this guy get away. He's got money. And so he goes after him. The servant of Elisha, the man of God, thought, behold, my master has spared this Naaman the Syrian by not receiving from his hand what he brought. As the Lord lives, uses the Lord's name, I will run after him and take something from him. Can't let this pagan get away without doing something for me. It's interesting, he refers to him simply as this Syrian. No respect for this other man as a person, and you would understand if you knew how the Syrians hated the Jews and the Jews hated the Syrians. Elisha apparently didn't feel the same way, or at least was willing to let God work in this other man's life, but Gehazi was very angry. And he's upset. He doesn't respect the personhood of this Syrian at all. And he calls him this Syrian. And he says, I'm going to go get the money. He needs to leave something here. Verse 21. So Gehazi pursued Naaman. When Naaman saw one running after him, he came down from his chariot to meet him. And he says, you okay? Is everything all right? He comes down from the chariot. And he asks, and he says, oh yeah, everything's okay. Verse 22 says, Gehazi, my master has sent me, saying, behold, just now, what wouldn't you know it? Two young men from the sons of the prophets have come to me from the hill country of Ephraim. And they said, please give me a talent of silver and two changes of clothes. Naaman says, oh, hey, take two talents. Take more. He urged him. He bound two talents of silver. That's a lot of money. That's a whole retirement. He bound two talents of silver in two bags and two changes of clothes, and he gave them to two of his servants, and they carried them before him. So he sends the servants, and he gives all this stuff to Gehazi. And he came to the hill, and he took them from their hand and deposited them in his house, and he sent the men away, and they departed. And then he went in, and he stood before his master, Elisha. And Elisha said to him, where have you been, Gehazi? And he said, nowhere. Now, if you had been Gehazi and you knew what you know about Elisha, would you have bothered lying to this guy when he stops you in the door and says, where have you been? Would you have bothered to even try to lie to this guy? It's just, you know what I think, honest? I think what happens is once we decide to do what we want to do, it kind of makes us a little bit wacko. I think what happens is once you've decided you're going to do something wrong, you get a little crazy, and you say and do dumb things that under normal circumstances you might not say and do, but because you're already committed to the evil, you're just not thinking straight anymore. I'm really convinced that happens. For biblical reasons, I'm convinced of it, but I've also seen it happen. I've seen it happen in my life, and I've seen it happen in other people's lives. But whatever the reason, he tries to lie to Elisha, who can read people's minds, practically. And as a matter of fact, that's what's happened here. And he says, oh, I didn't go anywhere. And Elisha says, oh, really? Did not my heart go with you when the man turned from his chariot to meet you? Oh, my goodness. Elisha was there in some sort of vision or something. He saw the whole thing happening. Imagine Elisha the prophet. He's there. He's having his lunch. All of a sudden, he gets a vision, and he sees his own servant, Gehazi. And he's watching, like on TV, Gehazi do this thing. And he's going, that little hot dog. I can't believe what he's doing. And so he meets him at the door when he comes back. But he knows even what's in Gehazi's mind. Look at this verse. It's a great verse, verse 26. Did not my heart go with you when the man turned from his chariot to meet you? And then he says to Gehazi, is it time to receive money, to receive clothes, and olive yards, and vineyards, and sheep, and oxen, and male and female servants? Wait a minute. You didn't give him all that stuff. But he gave him the money for it. And Gehazi was thinking about all that stuff. It's not the money. It's what it buys. It's like one man said, it's not that I really worship money. It just calms my nerves. And what's amazing is that, in that verse, it goes beyond what he actually got in terms of cash. It went into his dream world, into what he was dreaming about. And Elisha said, is it really time? Is that really the priority in your life? Man, verse 27. Now here comes the real clincher. Therefore, the leprosy of Naaman shall cleave to you and to your descendants. You're going to pass it on. So he went out from his presence a leper, as white as snow. That was the judgment of God. It wasn't just Elisha. It was the judgment of God. What an amazing thing. And so you have a man who converts to Yahweh and loses his leprosy. And you have another man who turns away from God and gets the leprosy. Just a couple thoughts, and we'll close it up here. It's an interesting thing to me that somebody so far from God's covenant and people should be so thoroughly converted. Someone who's never heard, wasn't even thinking about it. And we don't get the impression that Naaman was a man who really in his heart of hearts knew there was only one God and all this stuff. Not at all. He was just a rank pagan. He was happy to worship Rimmon, except that he didn't like having leprosy. And then when he heard he might be able to get rid of it, he sort of stumbled into the idea that Yahweh was God. But once he realized, because of the witness of this nobody kind of little girl who tells him, that's where you can find the truth, and he takes it and finds it. Once he hears it, this guy who's so far from God ends up coming straight in. And that happens so often. Oftentimes it's people who just hear the gospel for the very first time, and all of a sudden it breaks in on them, and they say, wow, I want that. And yet on the other hand, you have people who are so close to the truth for so long in their lives, and they devalue it, and they don't think about it. It's interesting that somebody so far from God's covenant and from his people should be so thoroughly converted. But God does that on a regular basis. He did it with Rahab. He did it with Ruth. He did it with the sailors that threw Jonah overboard. He did it with the Ninevites through Jonah. And he's done it through countless, countless millions who simply said, well, if those people don't want the truth of the gospel, I sure do. I want it. And I'm glad to be cleansed, and I'm glad to belong to God. On the other hand, it's interesting that somebody so close to God and to his work and to his people should be so far from his mind and from his purpose. That is fascinating. Gehazi is a great example of a person who's very close to the work of God, sees it, in fact, on a regular basis, working for Elisha. Maybe he was just too close for too long and had taken for granted the glory of knowing what God was doing. That happens too. To be so close to God's purposes and to know the truth and then to not care, is that something, is that a decision a person makes? No. What happens is, and life presents these kinds of these tests to us, but what happens is, it's not greed. People say, well, see, this is greed. This is what did it. It's the greed. No, it's not. Greed is the symptom of something else. Greed is the symptom of an unconverted mind. Greed is the symptom of a person who doesn't know that God is more important than money. And you can yell at the greed all you want. It won't do any good. The person doesn't realize that God is more important than money. The person doesn't understand that when they have money, it comes from God in the first place. The person doesn't understand the priorities of God. That was the problem with Gehazi. And what's amazing is that he was so close to the things of God and didn't think like God at all. It happens. And life presents us with these kinds of things. And we face situations where the Lord says, all right, let's pretend I really know what I'm doing. How should you respond? If, for instance, just pretend for a moment that I knew what I was doing, that I was sovereign in all of this, how would you act if you knew that this was a good thing that God was doing by saying no to all that money? How would you act if God came and said, I am doing this on purpose. I don't want you to have the money. Would you say, oh, you got to be mistaken. You know what I could do with that money? Or would you say, Lord, you're right. You're absolutely right. I'm dodging a bullet. I'm going to trust you. We are faced all the time with it. He did a couple of things. Notice, he discounted the prophetic word. He knew Elisha had already said no. He should have automatically realized, well, if Elisha said no, that means God is saying no, and that means I have to say no. End of conversation. I have to trust God. I'm not going to go after that. But he discounted the word through Elisha. And secondly, he reversed God's priorities. God says, trust me, I will give you what you need. That's what Jesus said very clearly. Seek first the kingdom of God. All these things will be added unto you. Gehazi turned that around. Even though he was close to the work of God, he turned it all around. He got the priorities backwards. You know, you get to the end of the story, and I like chapters that end with everybody being healed, you know. But that's not how it ends. It ends with a very sad note. It ends with a man with leprosy. It ends with a man who ruined his life because even though he was close to the work of God, he never learned to think like God, never learned to think like the Lord. And I suppose that's how we need to leave it. I suppose in order to apply the word effectively to us this evening, we just need to say, okay, I don't want leprosy. I'm going to learn, you know, from Gehazi. And if the Lord is challenging me in my life right now to trust him and to think like he does about whatever the thing may be, maybe it's not money, maybe it's something else, but the Lord is saying, think like me about this. Trust me and don't trust the world. Don't trust mammon or whatever. Then, Lord, that's what I want to do. Let's bow our heads. So take that thing, whatever it is, and lift it up to the Lord and ask him to take it, to help you think like he does about whatever the thing may be. And whatever the inclination of the old nature, the inclination of worldly wisdom, the inclination of even sometimes people who have advised us, but we kind of know they've advised us against God's own wisdom, against all of that, put that thing on the altar and say, Lord, I really do want to live and think like you do about this particular issue. Father, we thank you for reminding us of this very sobering story, this account with Gehazi, a reminder truly of your faithfulness, but also a reminder that what we do know about you, we are responsible for. We thank you for your grace to reach and touch a man who wasn't even looking for you. And we thank you for the reminder that those who know you well are responsible for the wisdom that you have given to them. May we walk according to that wisdom, Lord, and may we be useful in your hand. And when the tests arise in our own hearts and spirits about the frustrations in our lives and the temptations, when they arise, Lord, may we make a clear and faithful decision at each point. We trust you in Jesus' name. Amen.